Hello, all my beautiful Broadway friends. It's me, your Broadway buddy, Ben Cameron, back with a very special holiday episode of the Broadway Cast. I cannot believe we're already here. It's the holiday season. Here in New York, the trees are lit up. Rockettes are kicking up their heels at Radio City. Saks Fifth Avenue's window is dolled up for the season, and folks are flocking from all over the world to take in that magical holiday air slash smog in New York City. You know, when you think about it, many of us had some of our earliest exposure to theater in Christmas pageants, choir performances, holiday dance recitals, not to mention that must-watch holiday fare on TV and movies. I remember so very well watching The Sound of Music every year around Christmas. I also remember playing Ebenezer Scrooge in A Christmas Carol at the ripe old age of 12. That's a lot of silver hairspray and felt-top hats, which, as you will find out in this episode, is not such an uncommon stop on your road to Broadway. Nowadays, we have a whole slew of holiday offerings on stages all over the world. We've got A Christmas Story, the musical, White Christmas, to name a few. So to get into the spirit, we've gathered together three Broadway superstars whose names and fates are linked to the holidays. We've got the original Buddy the Elf in Elf the Musical, Sebastian Arcellus, Tony-nominated star of Holiday Inn, not to mention A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, one of my favorites, Bryce Pinkham, and the OG Grinch and current Hades in Hadestown, the one and only Patrick Page. Now, what unfolded over the hour and change that we got to speak is really nothing short of magic. I think you're going to be especially taken with the care and respect that these gents have for each other and the iconic roles that they've played. So, put on your kerchief and put on your cap. Get ready to feel snuggly all over, because this is a holiday episode for the ages. Now, before we get into it, as always, I've got to remind you that you've got to subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. Rate the show, review the show, share the show with your friends. Also, if you would like to follow us on social media, you can do that at The Broadway Cast. Follow me at Ben Does Broadway. And if you want to support us even more, you can become part of our Patreon family by clicking the link in the liner notes, my favorite line to say. And we're going to make some behind-the-scenes content just for you, our Patreon family. Isn't that marvelous? So we hope that you will support us and follow us in all those ways. Now, it's time for a holiday extravaganza spectacular like no other. So what do you say? Let's go on with the show. Well, a ho, ho, ho. They are here now all together, which is always an incredible feat that we can pull this kind of talent together at this hour of the morning. You don't know that, but this is morning that you are getting these gentlemen. Let's say hello to these holiday punks. Weird. Objectifying. We'll start by saying hello to Bryce Pinkham. We know him and love him from Holiday Inn and Gentleman's Guide. Good morning, Bryce.
Good morning, indeed.
Tell us a little bit now. You are knee deep in previews for Ohio State Murders. How's that going?
It's good. I've decided that I only do shows with murder in the title from now on. So I guess Murder, She Wrote, the musical, is next. Somebody's got to write it.
Jessica Fletcher is clearly the role you were born to play.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's always been, inside me somewhere.
It's important to know your brand.
I am having a wonderful time. Who would turn down the opportunity to be near Audra McDonald on stage? And every night I'm just like, cool, I'll have my masterclass from the stage. And so it's been an incredible experience just to watch her work. The show is mostly 75 minutes of Audra doing this incredible monologue, telling the story, and a few of us pop in to sort of populate her memory. And it's it feels super, super important and part of the commitment that the Broadway community made to center Black voices and center Black women. And, you know, Adrienne Kennedy, the playwright, is finally making her long overdue Broadway debut at 91.
Amazing.
You know, a celebrated playwright who never had a play produced on Broadway. So this is the first time one of her plays is there, and feels very special to be a part of the group that's bringing it to life.
And also at the James Earl Jones Theater.
Indeed, the newly renamed James Earl Jones. So yeah, there's lots of good feeling around the space for sure.
Now, do you and other cast members hang out in the wings and watch Audra tear into it? Or do you have to get back into your own zone?
Yeah, no, that is it. It's a very sort of like, it's like theater church backstage. We're all sort of like, watching the queen perform the ritual every night, you know, just sort of like peeking out from behind the curtain. It really is incredible to see her do what she does.
And opening night's coming up December
8th.
All right. We're looking forward to that. Sebastian Arcellus is here, the OG Buddy the Elf, and just moments ago stepped off stage into the woods. And Sebastian,
you can say it. I'm the one of us I'm the one of the three of us that's unemployed. You can say it.
No, I. Why did you take off, Sebastian?
You know, as it turns out, I was only ever invited to join Into the Woods because Brian, thank God for his illustrious career, took a leave of absence to go shoot a film. So my wife, bold as she is, said, hey, if Brian ever takes a leave of absence, you should think of Seb. And he did, and they did. And so it was this beautiful synergy and just a bit of luck that that came down and created what, as it turns out, was one of the most complete theater experiences of my life. It was short, but it was very, very sweet.
I just think that the rise of this production has been so fun to watch these incredible luminaries get to come in and do what is arguably everybody's favorite musical.
It's wild, you know, and to that end, actually, when people saw the show or when they, you know, obviously still coming to see the show, it's very much like they sort of start to share their experience with the show, not just how it may have affected them, but their history with the show and what it means to them. Obviously, we can't pretend like we're not different people after the last few years of our lives. And so I think it's hitting differently for a lot of us. And it's just like sort of all of life's questions and answers are in there, you know, right? So coming out on the heels of the pandemic or in the midst of it as we are, it definitely hits home. And I think people are walking away both heartened and affected, and that has been a beautiful experience. So it's a beautiful telling of it, and to get to do it with Stephanie was beyond all description. So it was pretty dreamy, not to be cheesy.
Had you been on stage together before?
You know, the only other time was when we met, which was doing Wicked on tour. And then we did Wicked for a short period on Broadway together. We actually had our 15th wedding anniversary on stage, you know, performing in Into the Woods. And we actually got married at City Hall and went and performed Wicked together on stage on Broadway as well.
Come
so
on.
it was like a 15 year bookend, you know, while you're telling the story and playing roles that you've dreamt about since you were 16. Right. So, it all of it doesn't make sense, but it was so much fun.
I mean, having you in the show, though, I know you said that Stephanie told them that that's what they should do. It's such a no-brainer. When I heard you were going, I was like, well, yes, this is right.
Well, I love that. I mean, you know, as it turns out, I think we have so many different parallels to the story, you know, in a larger sense, that we joked that I don't know if they know how much we really are the bakers. And
do you bake at home? Just tell me you bake at home.
I mean, I try, but I'm actually, the irony is that I've actually been gluten-free since 1995.
Oh,
so, like I'm silly.
The first gluten-free baker.
That's it.
Now that adds a level and a layer to it that no one could have seen coming.
That's right. I brought the first GF bakery into the woods. And it's fully celiac sponsored bakery. Of course, Steph jokes that, you know, I can't have carbs and she loves them. So we sort of have half the bakery is mine, no cross contamination, and half is hers.
And that's what makes a happy partnership.
Yeah, exactly.
Foop, foop. Also with us, who is currently absolutely 100% Mr. Christmas this year, with Spirited having just come out. I just saw it. This is the legend, Patrick Page, here with us. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you, Bendy?
I'm so good. Well, if you were wondering if we were lying about Patrick being on the show, you just heard that voice, and now all of your doubts have been quelled. I saw Spirited. It's wonderful. You're
Thank
wonderful.
You. I'm just so delighted to be part of it.
It's so joyous and big and current and fun. And it's fun to watch you break out and be so wonderfully silly in a lot of it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I just love being, you know, in a comedy, having done Hadestown now for 6 years. To be able to, I also shot a season of Schmigadoon, which is now going to be called Schmicago in Vancouver. Right. I got to be silly with that. So that's a joy. I've got to find some more comedy when I leave the underworld,
which is coming up pretty soon. Fun fact, Patrick, I'm going to be in the audience at your last show. I'll be there.
Are you really?
I am. I'm coming. Yep. I'm not going to miss that. Are you kidding me? Be a part of history if you can. Let's trace it back for the three of you, for the delight of our listeners. Where have your lives intersected? I think we've established Sebastian, Patrick, Schmigadoon, Schmicago. Where else have your paths linked or crossed throughout your careers, all three of you?
Well, Sebastian and I did A Time to Kill together on Broadway.
That's right.
Yes.
Which I absolutely adored working with him. And
likewise.
The show was short-lived, but I really loved doing it. I remember
so at
the time, I said, I could play this character for a long time. It was very satisfying to play. It was very well-made in that way and lots of fun and just extraordinary actors in it, Tanya Pinkins and John Douglas Thompson. And I mean, it was amazing. And Sebastian Arcelus. So that's where our paths crossed. How about you guys?
And I loved auditioning for it.
Can I tell you something?
The audition story about that show, but we probably don't have time for, but it's pretty funny.
Tell me if I'm all intrigued.
Now you have to say it.
Oh well,
quick,
is you know, I was auditioning for a Southern lawyer who had ambitions to be a politician, and so I thought, oh, I don't know anything about that. Who could I model this on? So I modeled it on the senator and television pitch man and actor Fred Thompson. And so I watched all these videos of Fred Thompson, and I came in to do this Fred Thompson impression for my audition, and sitting there to go into the room to audition before me was Fred Thompson.
Wow.
And he went in, and he was in there for something like an hour. And I just thought, oh, well, that's it. I mean, he's got the part. I'm doing a pale imitation of him.
They were like, can you do a little more Patrick Page? Can you do it a little more like
that's
Patrick
what they were
Page,
saying.
Fred?
Well, as it turns out, he was being seen for the judge, and I was being seen for the prosecutor. So it worked out just fine. And he was a lovely man, and we had a friendship while we were doing the show. And Fred was this extraordinary human being who was at the time dealing with cancer, and no one knew. And he came in one day with his head shaved. And then he would have line problems on stage. And those of us who who didn't have cancer and weren't in chemotherapy would sort of find ways to improvise and give him a sort of what the next line was. And one day he came into my dressing room, and we had a lot of conversations because we were both interested in politics and we were on different sides of the aisle. And one day he came into my dressing room and he said, listen, I'm going to tell you something because you're my buddy and you should know, but he said, I've got cancer, and that's why I shaved my head. And he said, on the days I have chemo, I sometimes don't even know where I am on stage. I can't find anything. So I really appreciate you bailing me out. And it was the first time we knew anything about that. And it was really such a lesson in humility about what this man was going through, and being non-judgmental about the fact that he occasionally couldn't find his way. And I just adored him. And of course, he passed away sometime after that. But I think it was also just a lesson for us nowadays in, like, you know, somebody can disagree with you ideologically and be a magnificent human being. And Fred was a conservative Republican, but just a beautiful, beautiful soul.
And that speaks to the beauty of, I think, this community that we're in, to a degree where you were able to circle the wagons around him to support him, not only off stage, but on stage.
While he was in the show that he had cancer. I think, I don't know, Seb, if you knew, I don't know who else knew, but very few, including.
Yeah, he did not mention it to me. Obviously, we knew something was going on, and like you said, there was sort of unspoken support for him throughout the experience. But I second that he was an extraordinary man, and I too, being on different sides of the aisle, and yet this man is kind of a titan. I mean, he was one of the original Watergate lawyers, right?
His accomplishment. Remember, Sebastian, when we were in rehearsal, it was a trial play, a play about a trial, and we had this lawyer in the room. So we would constantly, he should have been paid many times what he was paid, because he was constantly answering legal questions and serving as a dramaturg.
Yes. It was great for table work.
Yeah.
And for a laugh. He had that so slow, soft Southern drawl. This is beautiful.
I always wonder about that in courtroom shows and Grey's Anatomy too. Like, who's on the sidelines telling them exactly what the hell they're saying what that means, and if it makes any sense in the real world. Want to get to something, friends. We like to break the ice a little bit with a game. And this is particularly silly today, as we're celebrating the holidays on our show today. We're going to challenge each of you to give us a holiday presentation in spoken word of some of our very favorite Christmas songs that I have hand selected for you, that if you could present them in a dramatic reading fashion. I think, Sebastian, this just popped up in the chat for you, maybe, if you want to have a look.
As long as I don't have to follow Patrick Page, I will partake.
Make Patrick
partake.
Go last, please.
Make him please go last.
Oh, no.
I'm
making Patrick go last.
I'm happy to toss it his way.
You must reveal that we have done this at, we've done this at Broadway sessions. Bendy always, we do a little improv where he gives me a lyric that I haven't seen. And then we do this. So I have an advantage.
You do. And if you, for everyone listening and for Sebastian and Bryce too, you want to look up Patrick doing Anaconda and popular from Wicked. These are some of the big hits that he's been able to pull off in spoken word. All right, Sebastian, if you could deliver just these few lines for us in his...
Is there any direction ahead of time, pacing?
I feel like I want this to be as House of Cards high stakes as possible.
Oh, so direct to camera. Although I have to look at these. Okay. Okay.
Direct to radio.
Yeah.
Frosty. The snowman. Snowman.
I have a question while he's setting up.
Oh, yeah.
My question, Bendy, is this podcast video or only audio?
It's audio.
Oh, thank God for that.
But you all look beautiful. Have no fear.
I'm glad I got a second run at that because okay, here we go.
Action.
Frosty, the snowman. Snowman knew the sun was hot that day. Hot that day. So he said, let's run and we'll have some fun. But now, before I melt away, Frosty, the snowman, had to hurry on his way. But he waved goodbye, saying, don't you cry. I'll be back again someday.
Wow. Wow. That's the darkest part of the song. So I felt it was appropriate.
Yeah. You know, I watched Patrick on one of your videos where you were reciting a sonnet, and I was like, were I ever to have the pleasure of doing Shakespeare professionally, the first phone call I would make, obviously, after my reading of Frosty the Snowman would be to you. And I'd say, help me, please.
That's my my favorite thing is to work on a piece of text with a friend. So,
well,
I thought it was expertly done, Sebastian. It raised a lot of questions for me. I have a little bit of an internal struggle going on.
Yeah, I think there's an existential crisis going on with Frosty that I wasn't particularly aware of.
This is going to take some time to process.
The man speaking about Frosty, he seemed untrustworthy, but like maybe a psychopath, but maybe like your best friend. You're not sure.
No.
And you know me so well.
Speaking of brand,
I'm curious how he waved. It says he waved goodbye, but what, with his stick?
Yeah.
His stick hand?
Yeah, what did he wave? There we get to the heart of it.
We know that he was a man, so far as the text tells us, so hard to say.
And where's he going?
And I'm pretty sure he's going down to Hadestown. So hot as the sun. Bryce, this, I'm really delighted. This is one of my favorite holiday tunes, Shirley Temple moment.
Until now.
No. I don't believe that's true at all.
All right. I can see me now on Christmas morning creeping down the stairs. What joy and what surprise when I open my eyes to see my hippo hero standing there. I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus will do. No crocodiles or rhinoceroses. I only like hippopotamuses. And hippopotamuses like me too.
Oh my gosh. Oh my God. I'm sorry. I'm openly weeping.
The thing is, I've never encountered this before. I've never heard this song. How have I never heard this either. Song?
You made it. You don't know this song? It's an old Shirley Temple tune. And it goes, I want a hippopotamus for Christmas.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going.
But now it's no longer hers.
Well, it was new and fresh.
Yeah. the standard has been raised and changed, really. All right, Patrick, here we go. Rounding out the holiday dramatic spoken word. This is a classic. The stage is yours.
I have a little dreidel. I made it out of clay. And when it's dry and ready, then dreidel, I shall play. Oh, dreidel, 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 I made it out of clay. And when it's dry and ready, then dreidel, I will play.
My dreidel is so playful.
It loves to dance and spin. A happy game of dreidel. Come play now.
Oh my God.
Let's begin.
Oh.
Wow. Everyone's applauding into their audio devices. That was exceptional.
I think you might need to put a little E next to the podcast.
That's just a little explicit. Not for language, just for intention.
Yeah.
Just for some really, really intense subtext there.
Is there anything better than a pause after Patrick Page says something, knowing that the next thing you're going to hear is also Patrick Page's voice?
There's nothing better.
You really can have it all.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, this is the thing about why I had to know whether it was just audio or video, because it went audio, you have to be very careful with the pauses, or people, you know, they think it's over. Mm.
No, we're hanging with bated breath for your next word. I can tell you when
I love how he discovered. Sorry, go ahead.
There was a moment when we were doing a Time to Kill where, you know, how sometimes like a little snippet of the show will pop up online on Broadway.com or something of that nature. And I made the mistake of clicking on and hearing myself on stage. And I was reminded of how annoyingly high pitched I can sometimes speak as compared to him. I was like, I said to Stephanie, I was like, do I sound like that? Do I sound like that on stage? She's like, it's your voice. And I was like, this is terrible. We have a problem.
Well, none of us can listen to ourselves. So,
Well, that is so true. I hate the way my voice sounds on every episode of this. In my head, I sound like Patrick Page. That's what I think I sound like. And I'm very confused to hear that's not the case on playback. Patrick, are you jarred by the sound of your own voice? You're like, yeah, that's it.
No, I have a very hard time listening to myself. Mm. I think, or looking at myself or thinking about myself or, you know, anything with myself is really problematic for me.
Mm. Well, and that's why we all became actors. Want to keep the holiday fun going, my friends. I want to know, what are some of your early holiday memories, specifically theatrically? Were there best Christmas pageants ever? Were you in the pageants or the plays when you were growing up? And was that something that kind of spurred your interest in theater? Bryce?
My sister was in a like a dance school when she was a young girl, and they had a production of The Nutcracker every year. And so my dad, rather than pay for her tuition, offered to both stage manage The Nutcracker and also play Drosselmeyer. And I got, of course, roped into playing Fritz. And so it was me backstage with an entire school's worth of dancing girls. And I was mortified. And then I ended up doing it like 3 years in a row. And by the third year, I was like, this is pretty sweet.
I liked it.
So that was an early like holiday experience was The Nutcracker. And thankfully, I didn't have to dance in it. But, you know, that music is just so quintessentially holiday. And it was a lot of time just backstage hanging out with future theater people. So yeah, that definitely inculcated me into this world.
Arguably, the backstage time when you're young is a lot of the reason I think we want to go into this anyway, because the backstage time is so sacred and fun and the people are so nutty and wonderful. My favorite people, certainly. I feel like that's a part of it. How about you, Sebastian?
You know, I wasn't a part of any Christmas plays back then, but I lived outside of New York. I grew up on Long Island. And so we'd come see the Rockettes, and we had obviously all the typical New York Christmas traditions, be it the Rockefeller Center tree and going to Macy's to see Santa. I always remember looking at the, they were so special back in the day. They still are, but the Fifth Avenue window. What I'm not finding the word, window dressings, you know, the displays. And we walk up, there would be lines, they like cordoned off, and you'd walk up and down Fifth Avenue. And then we'd always end up there was this next to FAO Schwartz, where it used to be on Fifth Avenue, where the Apple store is now in that area. We'd go to FAO Schwartz, and there was an old restaurant there. I think it was called the Boxcar or something, but it was down below where the Apple store is now. And all the different booths were actual little boxcars. And so we made a Christmas tradition of not on Christmas, but during the season coming in and doing Fifth Avenue. And we're now just crazy Christmas fanatics. I mean, my wife and I, this is not a joke, legitimately have an entire storage unit of Christmas decorations. Stephanie has been holding on to things since she was a child and amassing things for decades here, you know, and we just go full out on all holidays, really. Like, we're, you know, we're big decorators. And
couple of questions.
Our child is, what's that?
Couple of questions. Are you like day after Thanksgiving people? Are you day before Thanksgiving people?
Mm.
And do you disagree or agree on when this storage unit can be opened?
It's interesting. I have almost been I always thought of it as after Thanksgiving. It's starting to creep.
Oh no.
Almost because we just want to enjoy it for longer. I will say this. Her family has Thanksgiving dinner and then watches the, you know, A Christmas Carol. So it's like, and we start. And the next day her sister decorates. We're a little slower to the game. We used to have this tradition back here in New Jersey, where on a random day I would just show up and ring the doorbell and I'd be standing there with a Christmas tree and she would never know what it was. And that day we just, you know, launch into the season. But we don't mess around. And our daughter has taken that baton and is running with it. This morning I was gifted a Star Wars Lego advent calendar, so that every day of the month you open up a little new different thing. So we went down, even just this morning, down a rabbit hole on Apple iTunes of like mashups of Christmas carols with Star Wars, and I mean we just branch off in all kinds of directions. There is, by the way, an Imperial March Carol of the Bells that I highly recommend.
Oh, I'm gonna look that up.
Always fascinated by the fact that the Star Wars Christmas special was a thing at all. I didn't really know how we got there, but there's Bea Arthur singing a tune in the 70s.
This morning, my daughter was like, can you just not be the Star Wars dad right now? Can you just be my dad? Anyway.
Wow. And the answer obviously is no. No, no.
This I said, is who I am. I can't separate one from the other. I'm sorry.
Patrick, did you do holiday productions, pageants when you were in your youth?
I'm trying to remember. You know, I have this lifelong association with A Christmas Carol that just keeps coming back and back and back and back. So I played Scrooge, although I have no memory of it, very little memory. I played Scrooge when I was in elementary school. The only thing I remember about that is my brother, who's 19 months younger than me and whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Mike.
Happy birthday.
December 1st. He played it the next year. And the only thing I remember about it is that my dad, who taught theater at the local university, told me in no uncertain terms that my brother was a much better Scrooge than I was, which is no doubt true. I mean, he did it probably to take me down a peg because I was so obnoxiously full of myself, and Mike needed a little support, you know, and Mike was much better looking than me and much more talented. I just remember him saying that Mike was a better actor than I was, and that I had better really watch it. And that stayed with me. Then I played Scrooge again and again. I then played it at the Great American Melodrama in Oceano, California, when I was like 24 years old. And then I directed and wrote a version of it in Monmouth, Oregon, that my father played Scrooge in. And then that particular adaptation of it, I think, is still done out there in Oregon every year. The Madison Square Garden. Remember when the Christmas Carol was at Madison Square Garden,
mm-hmm.
that Mike Ockrent directed with Sue Stroman and I understudied Roger Daltrey in that. And I also understudied Paul Candel, who was playing Marley. And then Paul left the show to do Titanic. And so I took over as Marley, but then Roger got sick. So I then had to do many, many, many performances as Scrooge. And what I remember most about that is that because the house was so large, it was a 5,000 seat house, they'd gotten a special dispensation from Equity that they didn't have to stuff the program with a thing that said that I was in. So they make an announcement before every show, and they would say, ladies and gentlemen, the role of Scrooge, normally played by Roger Daltrey, would be played by Patrick Page. After which you would hear 5,000 people
and then oh, no.
in unison.
That is not a Christmas spirit right there.
No.
Oh, I know, but it was what I needed. And then I played it for a couple of years in Pittsburgh. And of course, now I'm doing Spirited. So there's something amazing in the universe that wants me to learn that lesson. And I'm still learning it.
I can't help but think that when you hear those people booing at that announcement, that every single one of them is your father telling you that your brother's better at it than you.
My dad was wonderfully supportive, ridiculously supportive. So I don't mean to paint him in that light. The fact that he said that one time is why I remember it.
Although when you directed him in the production, you didn't pull that one back out and be like, you know, that was a decent rendering, but I think Mike might have been better.
You know, it's so funny because... That was such a reversal of roles with me directing him in that. And what I remember is he had just turned 65, I think, and he hadn't acted in 10 or 15 years. And he couldn't get the lines under his belt. And I remember him coming to me and crying, sobbing, saying, I can't do this. And I was like, yes, you can. And he eventually would, he would place lines all over the set and he got through it. And then eventually, of course, after he got over those nerves, he was wonderful. And he played it for 10 or 15 years in Monmouth. It became a tradition for him.
Wow. That's incredible. Patrick, when are you writing the book? When are we getting the book?
My book?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. It's funny that you should say that because the one I have in my head is to write about like different kind of stories of that kind. Speaking of which, is totally off the subject, but I just am reading Bono's new memoir. He is a brilliant writer, absolutely brilliant. You should read it.
Okay.
can you also make it an audiobook, please?
Yes.
Naturally.
Yes. Thank you for that.
We were kind of talking about fathers, sons, and I know Sebastian and Bryce with kids. Bryce, are there New York holiday traditions, shows? Every Christmas shows or holiday themed shows are events, you know, people come from far and wide to take part in that energy of New York City. What are the events that you must do or have become traditions for your kiddos?
Well, we're early days in my house. So I've got a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old. So we're still sort of developing those, but I will say that, you know, being at Ohio State Murders, the James Earl Jones Theater is very close to Radio City. And, you know, you got to see the Rockettes. You just have to do it. It has to be part of your New York holiday experience. And certainly I see people, you know, people stop me on the street as I'm headed to the theater. Which way? So that one comes to mind for sure. But in our house, we're still like, we drive around the neighborhood and look for Christmas lights. And like, that is exciting to our house. We all look, there's Christmas. Oh, there's Christmas. So we're still in that like early days of learning what the holidays are. And frankly, you know, my wife and I, we're having discussions about like, how do we root these traditions in something more than just asking for presents? And, you know, so it's kind of fun to try and figure out ways to create traditions of meaning and, that, you know, teach lessons that span past the holidays. That's our goal anyway. You know, if we get the kids out the door with clothes on, we're winning. So if we can also get a couple holiday lessons in there in the next few years, we'll be pleased. But no Rockettes yet. No Rockettes yet for my two.
Well, soon. And then once you cross that line, there will be ballet shoes and high kicks just about everywhere.
Exactly.
When we're dealing with some of these shows, Elf, Grinch, Holiday Inn, there's often a very specific Christmas holiday-ish message that we are trying to send. why do you think that those messages resonate so much with audiences that we create these events? And is it a special thing to be able to present those? Lots of nodding.
I mean, yeah. To be sure, I mean, getting to do, at least in the case of Elf, getting to do a property, an idea, really a modern classic for everyone, but for young children specifically. I remember when I got the part, I was really thrilled at the notion that my young nieces and nephews might actually be able to attend an opening and have it be of significance to them. And to see the joy and unadulterated joy and open-heartedness and acceptance that sort of permeated that whole, it's just poured out of that theater and into that theater on a daily basis. Kids looking at you like you were Santa, you know? It was some of the most rewarding work I've ever done. Absolutely the hardest job I've ever done. And it really was about letting go and accepting the process just as much as the show was about, you know, letting go and accepting and acceptance and love and care. And it was, I mean, this might as well be called, right? Sorry, Bryce, the podcast of Green Furry Outfits. I mean, we, you know, those are also pictures that you can't escape, I will tell you, 13 years later. But
those tights. Tights are forever.
It was about as joyful and it was like totally all encompassing. There was no going, I know Patrick, you probably relate to this with the Grinch. I mean, you can't drop it for a second. If you drop that for a second, the whole illusion goes away. And these are, you know, big, full, you know, Elf was a big, brassy New York 2.5 hour like musical. And it was a real lesson in commitment and setting aside expectation, setting aside, you know, in some regard, the source material, because obviously we were going to be slightly, you know, significantly more saccharine than the movie, and just kind of like diving in, which was daunting, scary as all get out, but it was so thrilling and so joyful.
Patrick, what did you notice in the difference of the audience reaction with lots of kids in the audience?
Well, kids are honest, aren't they? I mean, they, sure. they will not hide their boredom, and they also will not hide their enthusiasm. Peter Brook, the probably the greatest theater director of the 20th century, who recently passed away, but he was the great, great guru of theater, and he had his own theater company in Paris for years. And what he would always, when doing Shakespeare or doing other classics, he would bring in school children, third grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, into their early run-throughs, and they would do the show for school children, and he would sit facing, not watching the actors but watching the children, to notice when they're becoming bored, when they're becoming interested, when are they engaged in the story, when are they not, because they're like a lie detector. And so, yeah, I mean, I think my father ran a children's theater called the Apple Box Children's Theater when I was a kid. So I have, and in high school, and I had tremendous respect and admiration for theater that's done for families and for children. You know, I did Beauty and the Beast for years, same thing. And it, to me, it feels like such an incredible privilege to be in that kind of work. And with Grinch, it was that, you know, and of course I know Sebastian sort of alluded to this. You're stepping into a character that they already know and have a relationship with and love. In a way, you're the protector of that character,
mm-hmm.
and you better guard that legacy when I had auditioned for Grinch, the producers, the directors and the creative team had decided that they wanted me to do it. And even the producers of the show wanted me to do it, but I had to be approved by the Theodore Geisel estate, by the Dr. Seuss estate. And so they sent out a gentleman from La Jolla, an old man, and he came to see me in The Lion King, and he just had to give the yes. And I remember he came to my dressing room afterwards, and I was still in all that lion makeup and everything. And I opened the door, and I thought he was going to throw his arms around me and say, "Thank God we found our Grinch." And he didn't at all. He just said, "Thank you." He said, "Thank you for your performance." And he left.
No. And
at that moment, I realized how much I wanted. I grew up with the Grinch. The Grinch was my guy. I had memorized the entire book. And, so I got my makeup off as fast as I could, and I ran down into Times Square, and I started looking for this old man. Well, can you imagine trying to find one old man in Times Square? And I don't know how I did, but miraculously I found this guy in a crowd, and I ran up to him and I said, "Look, I know that you can find someone who will sell more tickets than me. I know that you can find someone who will get more publicity and more press than me. I know all of that, but you will not find anyone who will guard this material, love this material, and protect this material the way I will. That's all I want to say." And I said goodbye. I got on the subway. I got up to 96th Street. My phone rang, and it was the director. And he said, "What did you say to that guy?" And I was like, "Oh my God, I really blew it." And I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I chased the old man down in the street." He said, "Well, whatever you said, you got the part."
And you're kidding me.
It's one of the only times I've done that, where I just cared about the character so much. And, you know, this cartoon character, but it was in my heart, because something goes into your heart when you're a child and it stays there. And then I took that lesson to be like, oh man, you're part of these people's story when you play a character like Buddy or the Grinch or Scrooge. You're already in their story, and you better step up to that, you know?
That's really extraordinary. My gosh.
Yeah, it's a hell of a mantle, a burden to carry, to have that expectation. I want to ask you, Bryce, going back to Holiday Inn, musically, we all have these memories embedded in us based on what certain holiday songs make us feel. What's the weight of bringing songs like White Christmas and the holiday songs that people know and love to an audience, while, you know, with wanting it to be warm and fuzzy while still maintaining your integrity as an incredible actor?
Yes. Well, first, I just want to say that story just made me realize that I have to chase down more old men in Times Square.
Mm-hmm. That should be the takeaway for all of our listeners today. If you're not doing that, that's why you're not booking.
Yeah.
You know, that sounds like the title of a Christmas song.
Yeah. Chasing down old men in Times Square.
Grandma got her song.
Yeah. To your question about musically, songs that we associate with the holidays, and it dovetails with what Patrick and Sebastian are talking about, material that we know so well that we have, you know, core memories formed around as children, and how to protect that and do right by it. But also the tricky thing as performers is, you know, we're not those people. And so I remember thinking, well, I don't sound like Bing Crosby. Let's just start there. And I had to sort of release that and say, great, I'm not going to do a Bing Crosby impression. I'm going to try and impersonate his heart. And if I can do that through my heart, and the voice that comes out will be mine and not his, then that's the best I can do. And so it was a challenge to get there, because I kept, you know, we're performers. We compare ourselves to each other. It's our disease, you know? And so I had a hard time with that song in particular, because it's a core memory of mine.
And I remember that was our sort of post Thanksgiving film in our house. And my mom loved that movie and loved that song and also loved the movie based on that song. So, but eventually I got to a place where I realized that people were coming to our show and creating new core memories, you know, especially young people who maybe hadn't encountered the movie yet. And that's what's so special, to answer another previous question of yours about doing these shows at Christmas time in New York, is you know that core memories are being made in your audience. Both young people and families are making that story that in a few years' time is, oh, remember when we saw The Grinch and Patrick Page was amazing, and we saw Elf and Seb was incredible, and you know that you're actually in the middle of that happening. It's a pinch me experience as a performer. And I remember on Christmas Eve performing, walking into Holiday Inn on Christmas Eve, and it was snowing. It was the first time it started snowing. And I was like, there's no way. I mean, it was, again, one of those, like, you got to be kidding me moments. So it's really going to snow on Christmas Eve when I sing White Christmas on Christmas Eve to all these people at the matinee. And, you know, you can't write it. You can't write it. And I think there is a sort of reverence, but also for the performers out there, you know, there has to be a certain freedom to make it your own. And to not just try and recreate what another performer has done, because that's always just a foolhardy mission, I think. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answered any or all of your questions, but that's my story, and I'm sticking.
It absolutely did. I want to throw a curveball at you because of these three musicals we're talking about in particular. They're big, splashy, dancey, wancy, big musical numbers kind of pieces. Let's talk about choreography. I want to know.
I would love to dance on the radio. Thank you.
Yeah. How do you? I'm not going to make you dance, although that would be really fun for me. What is this when you're presented with having to do these numbers and remain in character and tell the story? Do you feel comfortable in that? Do you fancy yourselves movers, dancers? How do you rise to the occasion? Or not?
I think or not for me.
I don't believe it for a second.
I think well, for me, I go straight back to backstage at the Nutcracker, terrified of all these dancers around me and not knowing a single step. You know, I had to write and left on each, you know, on each one of my shoes. I think you lean into the spirit of what's being asked of you, and you also come to the table humbly saying, these are my limits. And, you know, if you're lucky to have a compassionate choreographer who will help you and give you things that, you know, are not going to fully expose me as the fraud that I am. But yeah, I always tell people I will move with the best of them. But if you want this part to have dance, respectfully, you might need somebody else. So I love to move. I'll move in all sorts of different ways. But you know, the dancers we have in our industry are athletes of a different nature and are highly skilled individuals. And so to attempt to, you know, I like playing basketball in my backyard, but I'm not going to go down to Madison Square Garden and try and hop on the floor, you know? So that's my sports analogy for it. I think it's, you know, something I love doing, but that doesn't mean people love watching. No. It.
Go ahead.
I can tell you that in Elf, I had these beautiful, beautiful shoes, DeLuca green curled Elf, you know, slippers that were just magnificent. What they did not have were tap, I don't even know what you call it, metal on the bottom of them. They were not tap shoes. And we had big tap numbers. I tapped without the sound. I can tell you, speaking of the grace of our choreographers, God bless Casey Nicolau and his associate on that show, Casey Hushen, because I met with them. I met with Casey Hushen several times prior to the beginning of rehearsals to try and get up to speed on what had to be this big old splashy tap number at the end of the show. And I worked my way through it, but definitely mover. Definitely, I was an athlete. I got soccer, baseball, and basketball in my blood. What can we do? You know, but yep. Man, no one needs to see me dance. And according to my wife, I do this weird thing when I dance where I like stick my, like Michael Jordan, like stick my, or just not as well, like my tongue, like in my cheek. So I'm like, I'm like dancing with this. She's like, you can't do that.
A character choice.
I was like, I'm doing the best I can.
If it's a big stage,
there.
It doesn't matter.
But again, it gets back to commitment, right? It gets back to like letting go and fully committing. I can tell you this also, little side story. I was auditioning for Elf. And you know how you typically go into the middle of the room? You give your music and you go and you stand in the middle of the room and you do your audition. And I admit that when I first sang the tune for the audition for Elf, I sang fine and I felt committed, but I hadn't fully committed. And I could tell that I was just kind of disappointing them. And Casey, God bless him, he said, can you do it again? And this time just, and I can't remember the words he used. And I don't even know if he got the words out, but I knew what he meant, which was just go there. And I said, and it was actually sort of a seminal moment for me as an actor, I have to admit, where I said, I have to go all the way or what are we doing? And I remember I sat down on the ground in crisscross applesauce and I started kind of like leaning back, you know, forth. And by the end of the number, I was like sitting on their table, hugging the pianist, like peering down at 43rd Street down below. We had I'll say this in Stephanie's credit. There's the scene where he talks about going to, Santa's coming to town at Macy's. And so I'm doing the scene and doing the scene and they tell him that Santa's coming to town. And in the audition with the, Santa Claus is coming, Santa Claus is coming to town. And he starts screaming and yelling. I was at Chelsea's and I literally deliver that line. I go to the door, I open the door and I scream out into an audition hallway full of people. And came back in and I think they were all kind of shocked. Like, did he just go there? Outside the room, Stephanie had accompanied me to the audition because I was so nervous. And she was sitting next to a musical director friend of ours who literally in the silence of me going back in the room turns to her and says, good choice. And she turned to him and said, good direction. She's like, you got to go there, Seb. If you're going to do it, go there. This is what I think you should do.
That's a great story.
She's brilliant.
What you're saying about commitment, I've never put it exactly in those terms, but it really is absolutely true. That conviction and belief and just like go there.
Yeah.
Nike, just do it.
Do it. Is it a little bit of just letting go of the fear of looking foolish or being too much or, is that part of it? Getting yourself to get out of your idea of what you think the consequence may be if you do.
Well, it's a strange thing in our business. I mean, we dive in order to do it. And then the first thing we do is get self-conscious, I knew I got the phone call to audition for Elf and I was like, oh God. You know, when you have those moments, you're like, I don't know why or how, but I think this is for me. And I called my wife and I was like, they called me for an audition for Elf. And she's like, oh God. Because in some regard, I'm not particularly elfin in nature. Like, I think I also like the fact that I like taking on parts where someone might say to you after hearing that you're doing it or might say of you upon hearing it, really? Like, is that interesting? Interesting choice. When in reality, in your gut that you've got what it takes to, or you think you've got what it takes to sort of step up to the plate.
I think that's so important what you just said. Like there's many voices in the head, so many voices in the head. And there's the one that's like, I want this, that has some desperation in it. And then there's just like that voice way down that says, for whatever reason, I think this is for me. And you recognize it in hindsight. Like, yeah, I always knew, like I knew that with the Grinch. I think this is for me. And it's almost like you're watching the movie, like you've already seen the movie and you know you're supposed to do it. And then, yeah. you have to step into it.
Yeah.
I gotta yell at more people in Telsey's office.
I mean,
you're taking notes, kiddos.
That's the way. Yeah. Just let the quorum go.
We are coming up with a lot of lessons for young people.
Aggressive. We're looking for aggressive choices.
Fall away.
Get Stephanie J. Block to direct you in everything.
Now, I will also add that at one point in my audition for Hair on Broadway, I may have stood on the piano and I did not get the job. So, you know, there are limits.
Mm-hmm.
If you had stood on the piano naked, you would still be in Hair to this day.
Or you'd still be at Chelsea Studios, one of the two.
Yeah.
Want to touch base, leaving Christmas behind for just a moment. I just want to check in with each of you. Yeah, putting a pin in the Christmas for a hot second. Want to just check in on some of the here and now and moving forward in your lives and careers. December 30th, Patrick, will be your last performance in Hadestown, which is a bit of an end of an era. How did you come to the decision to leave?
Same voice, that one that just knows. The same voice that says, this is for me, is the one that says, it's time to leave. It's not a head decision. It's a heart decision. It comes from somewhere and just says, okay, now's your time. And the end of a calendar year. I've been with the show since 2016. And it's been a magnificent experience, unique experience for me to be with a show and a role through so many iterations, so many workshops, so many productions, off-Broadway, New York Theatre Workshop, in Canada, a very different production there, in London at the National Theatre, a very different production there, and then finally on Broadway, another very different production. And it was just the journey of a lifetime. So just kind of time now to move on.
Throughout all of this, you've been pretty public about your struggle with hearing loss. I saw even yesterday, you did a post where you were showing some of your hearing devices that you used during the filming of Spirited. Just quickly, how have you maintained and worked through that struggle in this industry?
Well,
you seem to be in a really great place with it.
I feel so incredibly grateful to be living at a time where there's technology that can help. You know, if I couldn't work if the technology didn't exist. I couldn't do this podcast right now with you if the technology didn't exist. So I just am so grateful, and that's one of the reasons that I try to get the word out, because I started losing my hearing in my 30s and I didn't get hearing aids until I was 55, I think. So I had many years of, I realized that much of my depression and anxiety was the fact that I couldn't hear people, and I couldn't participate in conversations, and I would have a lot of not just anxiety, but annoyance at other people, anger, thinking like, speak up, you know, use your voice, them diction, and it wasn't them, it was me. You know, I never said this to people. I would just stop participating. And so and with Paige, bless her heart, my God, what she's had to go through over the years. And so I just want people to know that their lives can improve exponentially with technology.
Yeah, it's remarable. Bryce, you know, I look at your resume and you bounce so easily between the musical theater and what we like to call the straight acting, the plays. you know, anything from the Heidi Chronicles and Gentleman's Guide. In that, what are your kind of proudest moments in those different playgrounds that you get to play in?
Well, first of all, I'll say thank you. And second of all, I'll say, you know, part of the reason I always wanted to be able to do that is looking up to performers like Seb and Patrick, who are also able to do that. And, you know, watching, one of the amazing things about this business is that you, if you're lucky, you get to sort of follow your heroes and then also join them on a podcast or on stage. And I remember getting some good advice in grad school, which was like, find people whose careers you want to emulate, who are, you know, a little further on in their career than where yours is. And these two performers you're having on, as well as others, I saw careers that I wanted to emulate, people who are doing Broadway musicals and Shakespeare and, you know, plays like A Time to Kill. And so I always knew that I wanted to do more than just one thing, because as these guys will tell you, that's the catnip of an actor is to find a new challenge, to find a new way to grow and stretch your own instrument. And so I was really proud to answer your question directly of going from Gentleman's Guide into the Heidi Chronicles. And, you know, I went to drama school. I didn't go to a musical theater school. And I thought that I would, you know, try and be in plays on Broadway and elsewhere. And so I didn't know that it would take a musical for me to get an offer to finally get to do a play on Broadway. And so I was really proud of that and really proud of the performance and the production. And, you know, another one of those, two others of those actors like these guys that I sort of chose as beacons, career beacons, was David Hyde Pierce and Boyd Gaines. And they had both played the part that I was offered to play in the Heidi Chronicles. And that just, to me, was a validation of that sort of, envisioning what you, and specificity of what you're actually after as a performer and a business person. You know, we're all running our own careers. And so I was really proud of that and proud to join the sort of tradition and lineage of that piece and be able to say, yeah, I do both. And I do want to do both. And I want to claim that openly that I want to be able to do both plays and musicals. And I don't want to be pigeonholed. So thanks for letting me talk about myself.
Well, and your ability to do that speaks to younger people who so often will pigeonhole themselves or believe people who are pigeonholing them to say, well, no, but you're a this or you're a that, because I can recognize that. And then I look at somebody like a Bryce Pinkham and go, not true. Look what's possible for me. And there's power and weight to that.
But it is important to say that, you know, I also had to learn the difficult lesson of, yes, but you also need to get a foot in the door and you also need to get work and you also need to walk through the doors that are open for you. And sometimes I think you leave, at least I left school being like, well, I can obviously do anything. So let's go, world. And the business had to sort of say, yeah, but here's what I think you could do now. And, you know, start to grow and branch out from there. So it's never a bad thing to get specific and have somebody say, hey, here's a place that I think you could work. Knowing that in the long term, you know, your goal is to grow a Patrick Page, a Sebastian Arcelus career out of where you start. You know, it's got to start somewhere and it's got to, you know, every tree starts with a seed.
And grows in its own fashion too.
Indeed.
Yeah. Sebastian, I've always thought this about you. You're a really loving person. And I know that sounds like I'm flirting with you on this podcast, but I've always felt that about you. And I've known you a very, very long time. You have a great spirit to be around. In thinking about career longevity, how much does keeping a balance in your life off the stage fit into having career longevity and not driving yourself crazy or becoming too obsessed or taking things into a place they don't necessarily need to be. I feel like you, in my mind, are a great example of that kind of balance.
You know, I appreciate you saying that. I try to be, and I don't know. I mean, there are certain things that I know with certainty, and that's that my family comes first. And then there's other things that I don't know at all, which is how to really balance it. I mean, in the end, I'd say I'm sort of imbalanced, which is that I'm far, like, and appropriately so, and necessarily so, far skewed towards just wanting to be present for my family, which actually makes trying to find the windows for work and almost like work that will coincide with that goal happen. I, you know, not to get too personal, but I remember, you know, in these last couple of years where I have to be honest, I wasn't working at all. Many of us weren't, but I, you know, I was thinking to myself, what is it that I really want at this stage of my life? You know, I want to put my child to bed and I want to work in in an environment where I don't have to leave my family. And just, you know, within a couple months, Steph and I are on stage together. It doesn't make sense. You know, it's sort of that, you know, idea of intentional prayer, right? Or just intention if you're not the praying type. So as I get older, certainly as I have family, I'm finding that balance is the goal. Ambition certainly is not. And success means balance. I find that I'm having a hard time finding the balance because really I just want to be where I need to be, which is, you know, with the family. So that's a really convoluted answer to your question. It's a juggle. We have to pay the bills. Health insurance is, you know, paramount. Bryce, all of your comments are so beautiful, but I look at you, man, and I'm like, man, he's that man's got it. And Patrick, I can't tell you, for me, having been a part of A Time to Kill, which we all love doing so much, and yet it did not, last as long as we might have liked, to get to then sit and watch you at New York Theater Workshop, and then again in the Broadway production of Hadestown, just completely soar and know, as your friend and colleague, that you were in a hit, and that you were getting to soar within that space, was like just food for the soul. You know, I think a lot of young people we sort of look at what other people are doing or what they have, and you compare yourself invariably, even if you try not to. And yet I find as you get older, I'm just happy for my friends. And I'm happy that if along the way I can find my place, and yet I get sort of inordinately upset if any job requires me to be away from my family for any extended period of time. It's almost unacceptable to me. So you start to narrow your scope to such a degree where you're like, how am I, not just when am I going to work, or how am I going to work if I want to balance what I really care about with what I love to do? And, you know, that's an ever evolving discussion in my head and in this family and in relation to where we are in the world. I guess also that probably is not to go on and on, but it's probably why as you get older, you also want to expand into other forms of expression, be it creating your own content or writing or producing or acting in such a manner that you can try and be a little bit more in control of your schedule.
It's amazing that you, when you became so clear and intentional that happened in Into the Woods with you and Stephanie,
it's shocking.
Even beyond that, that you were able to notice it and take in the fact that was the completion of an intention, and I think, you know, I really believe miracles are happening all the time if we're able to notice them. You know, when Bryce was talking about the snow falling as he entered the theater, you know, me talking about the Grinch coming from my childhood, that it really is about clearing away all of the stuff that we think we want because somewhere along the line, somebody told us we were supposed to.
Right.
But it is actually coming from our heart, you finding like, I know I want to be with my family. And then somehow there's some principle that nobody's been able to codify yet in a lab, but it exists. It is science. It is real. When you get clear like that, then things line up and they begin working along and in tandem with you, with what you've seen. And it's just miraculous if you're awake to notice it when it happens. And it can be tiny.
Yeah, and that's,
it can be tiny things. It can be, Bryce could have walked in that night and not noticed that snow, but he noticed it. It went into his heart. And it's, I think, you, when you appreciate and notice something, you get more of it.
Wow.
And not to, because what you said, you describe it so beautifully, Patrick, and not to turn the table, but, and it's still, we're very privileged to do what we do and how we do it, but it still comes at a cost. Like, you know, even getting to do Into the Woods, neither of us was putting our child to bed. And right. So the balance, you know, it works in one form and yet it shifts in another. And so it's like,
absolutely.
It's like
every great mythological tale, there's sacrifice on the way to the
there you go.
Destination. Yeah.
Exactly.
I just want to lift up something else that Seb said, which is that has taken me a while to learn. And I think for your younger listeners, it just has to be restated that there's a special power, and this ties into the holidays too, a special power that is given to you when you learn to celebrate the successes of others and not see them as a referendum on your own sense of failure. It really took me a long time to learn that there's enough pie for everybody. And celebrating when somebody like Sebastian at Patrick's show, you know, going, oh man, look at that great piece of pie he's chewing on. I'm so happy for him. That there's an incredible release of what is natural, a competitive, you know, I grew up an athlete too. So there's a competitive spirit. That does not serve us as artists and as human beings. You know, it might serve us on the court or on the field, but it can be confusing, especially in the early days when you see people getting things that you want. And back to this idea of the holidays and how do we teach our kids or our young people or our family to think less about getting and more about giving? It's so hallmark of me to say, but it's really true that there's something equally powerful yet unable to be codified about that, about giving celebration outwards, away from yourself and at your peers and colleagues, that is suddenly you start to do that and you realize, oh my gosh, all this stuff is coming at me and people are celebrating me. So it's really hard thing to practice, but you know, a lesson that took me too long to learn.
It's a longer game and we're all on the same team.
Yeah. And it's so important, Bryce, what you said, because and it's at the heart of so many of these Christmas stories, right? Scrooge being isolated from the community, looking at it enviously, looking at it with hatred, and then ultimately realizing there's enough for him. He can go over to his nephew's house. He can be part of it. The Grinch looking down at Whoville and thinking, I hate their singing down there. And then it's really just the sense of there's enough. There's enough song for you. You can go down and be among the people. And I think it's so hard nowadays for young people because of social media.
Agreed.
You look around and you think, oh my God, people are living these extraordinary lives. And of course, what you're seeing is a tiny sliver of their life. You're seeing that the little piece of their life that they chose to share on social media. And it really is a superpower to be able to celebrate the success of everyone around you and know that your time will come. The one thing I want to say to young people all the time is, this is a very, very, very long game if you're lucky. If Hadestown or any of these things had happened for me when I first came to New York, when I thought they should happen for me when I was young, I would not have been able to appreciate or handle them. Because I was in that mindset of me and them, as opposed to us. Here we are. And everybody's time will come. And the wonderful thing about the amount of content today on television and film and theater and all of that is there's some place out there where you're the only one who's can do it. You know, there may have been no role for someone until the day there is their role. And it's just about, again, it's that quiet part down deep that says, okay, this one's for me. Andre DeShields said to me about this, you know, it's like, take only those gifts that are for Andre and leave the others that are for everyone else. And if you get quiet enough, you know which ones are for Patrick or for Sebastian or for Bryce. You know, you have that little voice that says when Buddy comes along, Buddy the Elf, for whatever reason, this is weird. People don't think of me in this way, but this is for me, I think this is for me, you know?
Yeah, and not allowing and other people's things to be a comment on you in any way, shape, or form. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you go to physical therapy.
You go to musical therapy. Yes. Well, yeah, for any of these Christmas shows.
Which you will go to. And do the exercises afterwards, people. Don't just do it at physical therapy, goddammit. Gentlemen, this has been such a marvelous conversation. I feel really lifted. And thank you for sharing with us. This is really, really wonderful. I wish you
I want to take it to brunch. I want to take it right to brunch.
Let's go. To brunch we go. Tra-la-la. Bryce, Patrick, Sebastian, thank you so much. I hope to see all of you soon. Well, that was just a big, warm Christmas cookie for all of us to enjoy. I want to say thank you so much to Patrick Page, Sebastian Arcelus, Bryce Pinkham. Incredible artists. What a conversation that was. I absolutely loved it. What do I hear on the roof? Is that the clip-clock of reindeer hooves? I'm really in the spirit now. I think I might go caroling. So lock your doors, hide your kids, hide your wives. All right, my friends, until next time, got to remind you to subscribe to the show, rate us, review us, share us with your friends. It is the season of sharing and giving after all. Make sure you follow us on social media at The Broadway Cast. Follow me at Ben Does Broadway and get for your loved ones this year. What a great stocking stuffer to get them a Patreon subscription where they can get exclusive content made just for our Patreon family. All you got to do to support us that way is click the link in the liner notes. I'm wishing all of you an incredibly safe, warm, and happy holiday season, no matter how you celebrate. I hope that you are able to spend that with friends and family and feel that love that we feel in our theater community. All right, until next time, I'm your Broadway buddy, Ben Cameron, saying have a great holiday show.